Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Sophie Reynolds and today I'm at the Globe Theatre in London with Tim Carroll, who is in the middle of directing Twelfth Night, which will open here in September. Tim, we're going to be talking about the first act of the play. So perhaps let's start right at the beginning, first line of scene one. And I would say that this opening line of the play is actually probably one of Shakespeare's most famous, most beloved phrases, "If music be the food of love, play on." How do you approach that as a director?
By trying to find some opposition. Any line that is to be spoken with any energy has to somehow correct or contradict or have something to push against. So we take a very simple view on this with this line, which is that the band, the house band, are playing. Orsino comes on. They play on because they're unaware of him, but then they notice him and they stop because they shouldn't be playing when the boss is there. And it's because they've stopped that he says, "Well, no, play on." So one tries to make it a real instruction and not a piece of poetry.
Okay, but then obviously it turns into a rather beautiful metaphor when we're talking about his love, Orsino's love for Olivia.
Well, rather beautiful but rather disgusting metaphor as well, because he talks about vomiting. He basically says, "Force feed me with music until I can't take it anymore and I go off it," it being love. So he's talking about aversion therapy. He's saying, "Since I am suffering under love, let's try and have so much of it that eventually I will vomit it out and be over it."
It's really quite an amazing beginning for this play, because we're leaping into the middle of Orsino's story. He's been in love with Olivia for a long time and it hasn't been going anywhere. He hasn't been having any luck with it. So he's sort of turning away from that, wanting to get over his passion. But obviously for us, it's the beginning of the story.
Yes, I think it's a wonderful way to start the play, which makes it very baffling that many productions put it second, this scene. Many productions put the second scene before this, so that they can start with a spectacular shipwreck of Viola. But I think that's not trusting the construction of the play at all when you do that.
So your production begins quite in this normal way with the first act, first scene.
We're not changing the order of anything in the play. We're doing a very uncut text, as opposed to Richard III, where we cut very brutally and very much with an attitude about which bits we liked and didn't. It wasn't just filleting of what one pretends is a neutral kind, although it never is neutral. We were very blatantly cutting to suit what we wanted, whereas with this we're doing an almost uncut text.
And you don't particularly need to in any case, but the first act in any case is very swift. It sort of rattles along. It has a real energy to it.
I think the whole play has wonderful momentum. It is a long play. It will be quite a long production, but I think it's one of those plays where if you're doing it well, it doesn't feel long. Whereas Macbeth, which is a short play, can often feel long because structurally it's much less satisfying.
So tell me about your staging of the first scene. We're in Orsino's court, but on the stage at the Globe.
Well, as with everything at the Globe, we only know where we are really by attending to the text. So there isn't anything to denote Orsino's court. There's just the costume, which denotes that he is a very high-status person. You can see that he's obviously one of the posh people. And the music that's being played in his court is courtly music and not street music. So these things and the language place the scene for us much more than anything visual.
And Orsino himself, I mean, later on we have Mark Rylance playing Olivia. How have you dealt with the fact that Orsino needs to sort of counterbalance that in some way as a character?
It's quite hard to counterbalance Mark. I mean, he's a very particular kind of actor, and when we first did this production 10 years ago, we talked about Mark playing Malvolio or playing Feste. And in the end, decided that Olivia was a better part for him because, although it's only in 5 scenes, it's very central. And somehow the whole play revolves around Olivia as the focus of everyone's love and desires, Orsino as someone who has to be in love with Olivia, I think my main priority was to find an actor strong enough to balance Mark, but also someone of a very different kind of approach. And Liam Brennan is a very different sort of actor from Mark. He's very austere and simple, whereas Mark likes to do 7 different things with every line. And that's a good counterbalance, as is the fact that Liam isn't in the business of commenting on his character, which it seems to me is a particular danger with Orsino, that people play Orsino in such a way that within 2 minutes of him coming on, you know what sort of person he is. He's that sort of person who's in love with the idea of being in love, or other such fatuous formulations. Liam is in the business of just telling the truth all the time. So in this scene, he doesn't tell us that he's not really in love with her. He tells us that he is in love with her because that's what the words say.
It's a short scene, but there's quite a bit of exposition in it, and we sort of really understand the setting for the play. The next scene, scene 2, is very different. As you said, it opens with a shipwreck.
Well, it doesn't, of course. That's what directors want it to do. But The Tempest opens with a shipwreck. This opens with the aftermath. This opens with just a girl and some sailors on a beach.
So are you creating anything about what's gone before, or are you simply dealing with...
You'll see some sailors. See some sailors lugging some a trunk or two, but it's clear again that the... You know it's a shipwreck because of what they say in the scene. You know what's just happened because of what is said in the scene. If you fold that back in and do a whole number of people doing dance theatre shipwrecking, then you don't need to listen to the scene. The first bit of the scene becomes irrelevant. So I like to make the audience put it together for themselves.
But it's a quiet opening. There's none of that drama that you get at the beginning of The Tempest. It's simply moving on.
It's aftermath.
And it's the next chapter of the story, really, because this is bringing Viola in. Tell me about her in your production.
Well, she's played by a boy. That's the most important thing to say.
As they all are, actually, we should say.
It's an all-male company, yes. It's original practices, which means that we have a great opportunity to make the twins actually look very similar in a way that they never do in modern productions, both because modern productions, for perfectly good reasons, cast women as women, but also because the conventions of clothing, wigs and makeup in Elizabethan theatre allow for a much more stylized and thoroughly realized look, which incidentally allows for the creation of real uniformity between the twins, so that you can really believe, because you can hardly tell yourself, that people are mistaking one for the other.
And potentially that could get very confusing, because you have a boy dressed up as a girl, dressed up as a boy.
It already is a boy, that's right. So the sexual confusion, as well as the mistaken identity confusion, is given an extra twist compared to modern productions. It's not given an extra twist compared to the original, because that's how it was written.
One of the things that I always find quite amusing is how quickly Viola leaps to her decision to dress up as a boy. Is that something that, I mean, it occurs in a number of Shakespeare plays, but is that something that was quite sort of accepted as a normal part of the action?
I don't know. It was certainly not a very usual thing for women to do. So the speed of it is undoubtedly outrageous. I don't think there's much you can do to justify it, and you shouldn't. You know, some productions try and show you the fruits of their discussions about what sort of psychological process led to her wanting to do this. I don't think you can do that. I think you should just let her say it and then let other people work out why she said it. But it's certainly... it's a really interesting question, because it touches on one of the many things in Shakespeare that you can pick apart when you read the play, but in the theatre you don't care. Like his time schemes, which never make sense. They're always or both 3 months and 3 days at the same time. And nobody in the theatre notices or cares. In the same way, you never see people in the theatre going, oh, hang on a sec, she's hardly had a chance to think. She's not just going to say, I'm going to be a eunuch and go to Orsino's court. That's rubbish. They just go, oh, good, a setup.
Do you think that's why we accept it? Because it's funny?
Yeah, well, because it's a setup. It sets up fun. You know, we want fun to ensue, and we don't want to linger too long over how it gets set up.
The rest of the setup in the scene is also about obviously telling us that her identical twin brother is also lost at sea, but that he might be alive. There's the hint of that. And then, obviously, we hear about Olivia again, and then we hear about Orsino. So we sort of, we have all the expositions sort of that we need set up properly. And then we move, again, it's a really short scene, we move straight into scene three, and finally we're at Olivia's court. And we've got Sir Toby Belch, who is obviously quite a different sort of character.
Mm-hmm. Biggest part in the play.
Really?
More words than anyone else. That's one of those trivia questions. If you ask 100 people, I don't think any of them would say but Toby Belch is the biggest part. But that's right. In terms of the pecking order, it's a bit like a curtain call, the first act, in reverse. Not in reverse, in the same order as a curtain call, but at the beginning of a play, which is to say in the curtain call you bring on the characters in ascending order of importance. And now, I'm not saying Viola is more important than Orsino, but less important than Toby. But what it does do is it makes you wait for Olivia. It makes you wait for Olivia, and also, of course, Malvolio, who you have no idea you are waiting for. So that's a really interesting thing about the scene, two scenes from now, is that all of these are sort of... they're all talking about Olivia. Every single one of these scenes talks about Olivia.
Your audience, of course, will probably be waiting for Malvolio.
They may well, but they'll also be waiting for Olivia, especially at the Globe, where Mark's Olivia is very legendary. But, you know, that's okay. We don't mind that. We're living with that. We've decided not to be coy about it.
I guess to go for it.
Yeah.
So we have this build-up. We have Sir Toby Belch come in, and he's quite coarse and crude and drunk all over the place. And again, we're building up to seeing Olivia.
And we build up to see Andrew Aguecheek as well, because they... it's lovely the way in Shakespeare people talk about people before they arrive, so that you already have an image starting to form, and then there's something delightful about this spindly, rather sad-looking chap coming on, and we, you know, either conforming or not conforming, but delighting us because we've already been led to expect a pillock, and here comes one. You know.
And are you, how are you dealing with it? Are you sort of embracing the comedy and making it as absurd as you can? Or?
Well, you don't have to make it too absurd. I mean, I think the... The thing I hate in productions of Twelfth Night is when people are wearing or doing things that no human being would wear or do. And the Yellow Stockings is a very good example of that. You see Malvolio's go into styles of clothing which are really just reflect on the original director's choice of the period. And then when he got to this bit, he thought, now in this period, there isn't really an equivalent of Yellow Stockings, so... Oh, he'll just have to be in shorts and yellow socks or something. And you think, yeah, but that's not even in the same universe as the rest of your production. So it makes Malvolio actually insane, as opposed to someone who makes a terrible fashion choice based on being misled. Similarly, in the period, there are ranges of costume, and you can give Andrew Aguecheek a nice wide ruff, for example, which looks very pleasingly silly to us. You can give him very high... breeches so that his legs are very exposed in their tight hose, which again in men looks funny. You know, you don't need to make him look like a comedy character for him to look funny. And I certainly don't think we do very much about being funny in that scene, because I have a kind of, not even a theory, just an instinctive feeling that the audience shouldn't laugh much in the first half hour. I don't think there are really many laughs in the first four scenes at all, and I don't mind if there are none. I think there are a couple of laughs in Act 1, Scene 5, but not many. That mostly, we're just setting it up. It's not a sitcom. You don't need one laugh every 45 seconds. You can let the audience just get into the story, and then in Act 5, they're going to be laughing their heads off a lot, every 20 seconds. because you gave them a chance to get into it.
Yes, and to probably understand what was being built.
Mm.
The other thing, I suppose, is that Olivia's house is in mourning, so I don't know whether there's a problem there that Sir Toby and Sir Andrew sort of come in and perhaps aren't sort of conscious of that or reflecting it or respecting it.
Well, Toby's fighting against it, quite consciously. What a devil means my niece to take the death of her brother thus, you know. Why can't we just have fun here? Why on earth are we all still creeping around on eggshells 6 months after her brother died? Enough's enough. Which, of course, is the comedy motto. In the end, life won't be denied. In the end, however sad you might be about the loss of someone, in the end, life will reassert itself. So when are you going to open up to that?
Then we get to scene four, and we're back in Orsino's court. We're dashing around in all of these scenes. And we have Viola again, but this time she's in character and she's Cesario, so I suppose that's something the audience has to take in and understand, because obviously they didn't see that transformation, they just heard that it was going to happen.
Mm.
And we have the build-up again, because this time Viola's being briefed with her message to take to Olivia.
Mm. And it's the first time, of course, that we see her. It's not the first time in the plot, but it's the first time we see her trying to get away with passing for a man. So there is some pleasure in that. When I say I don't want laughs, I'm not being a killjoy. There is pleasure in seeing that Orsino is very close and looking very hard, and as it might be me looking at you, there's a real danger that at some point he's going to go, wait a minute, your hair's very, isn't it? You know, at which point the game would be up. So we enjoy that tension.
And even if he doesn't quite notice that, he certainly notices that there's something about her, because he's falling.
It's a near miss. It's an absolute near miss. He says, all is semblance of a woman's part. You look just like a woman. Now, we don't know he's falling for her yet. There's nothing to indicate that. But it sets it up.
Yeah.
You know, you're an awfully good-looking young man. You know, all of that, which we, of course, and because we've been to a play before in our lives, and I suspect even if we hadn't been to a play before in our lives, we know he's going to fall in love. We know, we can see that this is what this is aiming towards, that it's going to be a terrible mess because he's going to fall in love with someone and go, I didn't even think I was gay, but I'm in love with my manservant. What's going on? You know, and we're delightfully Olympian in our extra knowledge that it's all going to be okay when he finds out, but you're going to go through hell first.
And do you think it's a fairly interesting decision that he chooses the most attractive servant he has and sends him off with his love message? Is that tempting fate?
Well, again, I think in the audience, I don't think we care why he chooses her. We just want him to choose her because we know what'll happen when she gets there. And again, if we've seen a play, we know that Olivia's going to fall in love with her. I don't think the audience is surprised by any of that. Rather, it's the sense of delight of going, yes, of course, of course, of course. As Cesario, she gets sent to woo the woman. Brilliant. So they're really just happy that it's all being set up for them, because what they want is to see people suffer. You know, they want to see people getting into a terrible pickle.
And Viola's Cesario is also pleased to be sent on that message, because she's already told us that she wants to go to Olivia's house.
I don't think she is pleased to be sent on this particular message, because she has already fallen in love with Orsino. That's the trouble, she tells us. It's a baffled strife. Whoe'er I woo, myself would be his wife. So she's already been put in a very invidious position where I'm in love with you, but I have to go and ask someone else to go out with you. I don't want to ask someone else, I want you for myself. What if I succeed? What if I do it too well? And Olivia goes, all right, tell him to come and press his suit and I will accept him.
That is the shortest scene, and then we move straight into scene five, which is kind of the big one for this act. So we enter Olivia's house, and we have, first of all, we have the clown, Feste.
Mm.
And that's an interesting character. I'm not totally sure how are you approaching the clown, the fool aspect?
He's a professional jester.
How is he dressed in your production?
As a professional jester.
And what is that? What does that mean?
You'll have to see. It's very hard to describe, but there are proper sources that Jenny's shown me of, you know, the motley, which means different colours. Motley just means that you're party coloured, as it's called, which isn't necessarily the
the squares of colour that we're used to seeing, but it is a coat of many colours. So it has a very distinctive feel compared to the very tasteful other costumes. And he's a professional jester who's gone missing and now has to take his chances coming back. You know, will he be accepted back into the household, or will he be kicked out, which in this period means starving?
That's quite an interesting setup, isn't it? I don't think that's ever particularly explained, where he's been.
No, it isn't. There are theories, but nobody can prove anything. There's a line that Mariah says, where she says, "I know where thou learnt that saying, in the wars," which is a possible hint that he's gone off to be a soldier, but whether he has or not, nobody will know.
So we have this sort of the bit at the beginning between Feste and Mariah, and they're talking about where he's been and sort of setting up, I suppose perhaps part of the reason for that is that we can set up that Olivia, you know, has a strictness mm-hmm. about her at the moment, particularly, and she's in mourning, and the household is being sort of governed in quite a particular mm-hmm. way.
It's the fairy tale enchanted castle where everyone's asleep, you know, that has to be kissed back to life.
How do you think that works on the audience? This is finally the character that we've been waiting for.
Well, it depends what she does, you know. She, in our production, she comes in very calmly and she lays a sort of sprig of rosemary for her brother at his place at the table, which is kept reserved for him. And, you know, the atmosphere does chill. And she's chilly for the first few lines with Feste. You know, she remains extremely joyless throughout, really, until Viola comes in and she starts to get curious about him.
Finally, you sort of have the meeting of the two sort of lead female characters. And do you think there's an instant sort of recognition spark between them?
Well, who knows, but there certainly seems to be... There's a wonderful possibility for misunderstanding, which is that Olivia sees in Viola's eyes, I think, the love that Viola feels for Orsino, and of course understandably thinks that it's love for her. So she is rather... she's not a fool. It's not that she just goes, "Oh, you're a gorgeous young man, I'm in love." I think she does see tears in the eyes or great passion in the face and thinks, "Well, it's a young man, I'm a beautiful woman, he's saying it to me, make me a willow cabin at your gate. It seems as though he's falling for me." So, from the other side, of course, I think Viola does see a kindred spirit, someone who's lost her brother, like she has, someone who is in grief, someone who can't be true to themselves. And her heart goes out to her, so a sort of spark happens between them, but it's a mistaken spark, you know. It all leads very naturally to the mistake of thinking we are attracted to each other, when in fact their souls have an affinity, which is only crowned in Act 5 when Olivia says, "A sister, you are she." So she realizes, it's almost as though, I knew there was something between us, but what it is that you're meant to be my sister, that we're soulmates, not that we're lovers. But at least I wasn't mad.
One of the lines that I think is interesting in this scene is when Viola's asking Olivia to lift her veil or to show her face, and she says, "Excellently done, if God did all 'tis ingrained, sir, it will endure wind and weather." And actually, we have Mark Rylance playing Olivia, so his face...
It isn't ingrained at all.
No, not at all.
It's makeup.
So do you ignore that fact, or do you work with it?
That's only true to what it would have been anyway. It would have been a boy, very strongly made up to look like a girl. So the joke is not on Mark, the joke is in Shakespeare's original time, that we know we're looking at people who have lots of makeup on, but they are talking as though they're just like you and me with no makeup on.
And is that a form of flattery, or that the character is playing to each other, or are they makeup isn't there?
No, they act as though the makeup isn't there, and I think that's the reality. In the play, then neither of them is wearing makeup.
Right.
They're just, any more than a Japanese kabuki artist isn't wearing makeup in the play. It's just the convention of the theatre demands makeup. In the same way that in a ballet piece, you know, then they're not to be imagined as dancing. In their world, they're not dancing, they're just being. It's just a convention.
So Olivia and Violet sort of have this conversation. She sends Violet away, says, no, I'm not interested, but you can come back. And then she sends this ring after her, this token, and it goes with Malvolio, and that is obviously perhaps a beginning, a starting to look at the relationship that Malvolio has with Olivia.
Yes, yes. I mean, you see Malvolio fighting his corner earlier when he tries to get rid of Feste, that you can see he wants to keep Olivia to himself. He wants to train Olivia to think of him as indispensable. Because, you know, in his secret fantasies, he thinks maybe one day, which of course, you know, is never going to happen.
And yet again, we've got a servant who is in love with their master being sent
yeah.
with a message, a token,
yeah.
to someone else that their master is in love with. So we have this quite pleasing.
Cool,
and that's the end of Act One.
That's
with
the end
cruelty.
Of Act One.
Thank you very much.